When we're putting pen to paper or typing something up on a computer, we tend to get dewy-eyed for nouns and adjectives. But our guest this hour says it's time to verb things up, to understand verbs and learn how to use them effectively. She'll also show us where we go wrong with these unsung words of action. Good morning, I'm Veronica Rickert with you on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour is Constance Hale. She's a writer, editor, and the best-selling author of Sin and Syntax. Her articles have appeared in the New York Times, the Atlantic Monthly, and the Smithsonian. And her latest book is called Vex, Hex, Smash, Smooch: Let Verbs Power Your Writing. And we'd love to take your comments and your questions about language, grammar, and all things verb at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send your email to talk@wpr.org. And you can also like us on the Veronica Rickert Show Facebook page. And Constance Hale, welcome.
Thank you, Veronica.
Well, I think it's fair to say that you're on fire with passion for verbs. These are the action verbs that make stuff happen in language. What's so great about a good verb?
You know, Veronica, the verb, some linguists call the verb the little despot of the sentence. That's linguist Steven Pinker, because the verb is really the heartbeat of every sentence. And the idea of the little despot is the verb tells everything else in the sentence what to do.
Aha. And you think, I guess, that we've gotten a little away, or maybe we just don't understand how verbs work.
Yeah, I think it's more that we don't understand how they might work. I mean, really, we all use verbs all the time. In order to make a sentence, you need a verb, and we do that naturally. But I think when you're writing, you don't want to just do things by default. You want to have a higher awareness level of every verb, every word that you're choosing in the sentence, and definitely a higher awareness level of verbs.
Well, as I was reading your book, I was wondering if verbs, as the part of speech that we focus on, have sort of gone out of fashion. I mean, if you look at people's Facebook posts so often now, it's just almost a list. It's something like lovely fire, good wine, friends, happy. You know, there's no verb there. And I see that a lot in writing these days. And a part of it, I guess, is our online world. We're changing the way that we write. But do you think that we're losing track of why verbs matter?
Well, I think it is, first of all, just have to acknowledge that there are many, many more nouns in our language than there are verbs, and we actually learn nouns first as babies or toddlers, first learning to talk. There's nothing wrong with nouns. There are a lot of them around, and we use them a lot. It's just that in order for a sentence to really kick off and do something, you've got to have a verb. So really the most interesting way of expressing thoughts is to structure a sentence where you have a noun, a subject, doing something to someone or someone else. And that's the essential dynamic of a sentence. It's almost like a little story or a little narrative. You have a protagonist, that's your noun, and you have a predicament, and that's the rest of the sentence. It's what happens. It's the drama. So the reason that I'm focusing on this is what a lot of us do, first of all, a lot of us just talk in is's and was's and were's. We pick what's really the least interesting verb around, and that seems to be the default verb when we write of a lot of our sentences, when we talk as well. So there's nothing wrong with that. It's just that when we write, we want to kind of go back, look at that sentence, and see if we've missed an opportunity to make the sentence more dramatic, more powerful, make it say more.
So spice it up a little.
Mm-hmm.
Well, give us some examples.
My favorite example to think of is, say we were just describing, you're writing a stage description for a play, or you're writing a little scene in a novel, or maybe even in a piece of journalism, and I might say, the shoes are at the door, or the shoes are outside the door. Fine. That's descriptive. There's nothing wrong with that sentence per se, but that sentence is a missed opportunity. First of all, what kind of shoes? Maybe they're tennis, maybe they're boots, maybe they're Doc Martens. And what exactly are they doing? Are they waiting? Are they standing at attention? Are the boots slumped over next to the door? So right away, just by making the image of the boots a little sharper and then choosing a verb, you get something interesting happening. And of course, if you take that and you carry that through a whole paragraph, through a whole chapter, through a whole book, the writing is going to be more interesting. And you mentioned that I'm an editor. I do edit books. And invariably, if I hit a chapter, it often happens just after the middle point of a book where all of a sudden it gets boring. It gets my eyes, I start to want to take a nap reading the thing. And a lot of times that's a signal to me. I say to myself, well, let me go check the verbs. Hmm. And I'll look, and just by perking up the verbs in a chapter, you can kind of wake up the writing.
Can you overdo the verb thing?
Sure, you know, if you have a super active verb in every sentence and you're mixing your metaphors, the writing can almost seem muscle-bound or something like that. So you don't want to take this to an extreme where it doesn't seem natural, but a lot of times it's just a very slight change, a nuance. Sometimes it's actually just literally just a nuance. So, for example, I might write a sentence where I say, she ran quickly across the street. Well, I would stop and I'd look at run quickly. And I'd think about that and I'd go, did she sprint? Did she gallop? Did she canter? Ooh, I like canter. And that gives me an image of a horse. So, you know, it's often just a nuance of a difference. But what you're doing is you, in addition to making the writing a little more dramatic, you're giving the reader a visual image that takes the reader along with you in your story.
Now, are we talking mostly about writing here? You're an editor. Or are we talking about just the way we talk in everyday life, that we could really be using our words to be more dramatic, to be more interesting to the people we're talking to?
Well, I think it applies to both. I mean, most of us, I'm not a person who wants to make people overly conscious when they're speaking. It's important just to let words pour out and not feel self-conscious. But I believe that writing is a practice, and this whole art of whether it's using verbs or whether it's using good nouns, it's a practice. And so I think when you write and you allow yourself to stop and take a little care with those important words and maybe consider synonyms, maybe run over to the dictionary or the thesaurus, which I personally do all the time. Maybe sometimes when I have a manuscript, sometimes I just circle an uninteresting word and I make a little list in the margin for myself to try to just get my mind let things percolate up. And then from that list, I may go to a thesaurus. What I believe is when you do that, you get more and more in the habit. It's a habit that you're building, and your mind, because almost like your mind becomes more conditioned to doing it, then I think that is the road to being articulate when you're speaking as well. It's just you're conditioning your mind and developing certain habits of precision and clarity and beauty, actually, too. And then it does affect speaking as well as writing.
Well, one of the things that you do in this book is you try to smash some of these ingrained myths that we have about verbs.
Mm-hmm.
What are some of the top ones that you can think of?
Well, the big one, and this is probably not familiar to your average listener, but certainly familiar to those who have studied writing. There, if you read books on writing or essays on writing and you go back a century, you'll often see this sentence, prefer the Anglo-Saxon word. There's this idea that Anglo-Saxon words are somehow special or more English or more true. And you see that back in Fowler's Modern English Usage in 1926. You see it in Orwell's famous essay, Politics in the English Language. You see it in Strunk and White. And I questioned that when I was working on this book. One of the big pieces of research that I wanted to do was to figure out where that commandment came from and whether or not it had any validity. So I went back and I actually studied 1,500 years of English history. And 1,500 years in about 15 words, but, you know, I need a little more than 15 words. But, you know, basically the British Isles were the first inhabitants who left their language there, the Celts. I mean, there were inhabitants before that. But basically once the Celts settled after that, there were 8 different peoples that came and invaded the British Isles and, you know, would come and then would leave and would come again and would leave again. And they included the Romans and the Vikings and the Danes and the Angles and the Saxons and the Frisians and the Norman French. And all of these people came and they all brought their language and they all brought new words. And some of those words were left as a residue when they departed. Some of the words blended with Anglo-Saxon words and made altogether new words. And we have a language that is unusual in that it is the product of many different languages. What that means is it's very, very rich. We have synonyms for every word, and those synonyms derive from different languages. To me, that's the greatest thing about English, is its richness and the kind of versatility that it gives us. So when you're writing a sentence, you have a number of choices in selecting a verb. So we can be very, very precise. We can be nuanced. But we can also pay attention to sound and rhythm in the sentence. We just have a lot of choice. We have a nice palette. So it seems to me ridiculous to say prefer the Anglo-Saxon word. And in the end, we have somewhere, no one agrees how many words we have in English, somewhere between 300,000 and 600,000, depending on whom you're talking to. Why, if we have that many words to choose from, would we want to restrict ourselves to the 4,500 words that actually come from Anglo-Saxon? So that just gives you an example of one of the myths. Again, a lot of people may not have heard that, but if they've studied writing, they very well may have heard it. It's just this false idea that those Anglo-Saxon words, which, you know, English was Anglo-Saxon back in around 700 AD. It's been a long time since it was an Anglo-Saxon language.
Yeah, I'm kind of astonished that's still even out there.
It's just a crazy idea. And, you know, if we prefer Anglo-Saxon words, it means that we wouldn't use a great word like bungalow, which is such a great specific way to describe a house. Well, bungalow comes from Hindi, and moccasin comes to us from Native American languages here in the United States. So I just don't want to deprive myself of any of those words. So that's just one myth that I busted early on in the book. And for me, the history of English was really interesting. I had never learned it actually in school or anywhere else. And but then there's some other, I don't know, you know, less weighty myths out there. There's still the myth of the split infinitive, this idea that you're not supposed to split infinitives.
Yeah, tell us about that one. That one's
out
there.
You know, a lot of people that I know were taught that in high school. It's a point of pride that they don't split infinitives. So the idea there is, in English, an infinitive is just the form of the verb that has the preposition to before it. So I could say to go, and that's the infinitive form of the verb.
So like the Star Trek thing, to boldly go.
Exactly. So right. If you put the boldly in between the to and the go, you're splitting the infinitive. You're putting an adverb, which modifies the verb, in between those two parts of the infinitive. That is considered a no-no. Why? I understand what to boldly go means. You understand what to boldly go is. Generations of Star Trek watchers know what to boldly go is. What's the matter with that? Well, there's nothing the matter with it. And in fact, that rule exists because back in the 1700s, a bunch of priests and clerks decided that English didn't have a grammar and Latin had a grammar. And to be a real sort of, proud language, we needed to have a grammar. So they took Latin grammar and they imposed it on English. The problem is, Latin and English are totally different languages. They're structured differently. They work differently. So we ended up having a lot of rules in English that don't really match what we do in English. And there's always this tension because it's very natural to split an infinitive, and yet they're the English teachers that tell you not to do it. So that's just an example. It's kind of petty. It's not going to change the world if you split an infinitive or don't split an infinitive. But I wanted to try to give my readers a sense of just the real history of English and the real, because there's so many, the story is so great and interesting, and then we end up having these kind of restrictive and foolhardy rules.
Is that one still one that gets some traction, though? Because my sense, I think I've been edited against split infinitives, you know, recently in the past couple of years. So obviously some people still are, you know, sticking to that one.
Yeah, especially the copy editors of the world. Well, you know, I think Sonia Sotomayor, our Supreme Court justice, when she was being at one of her confirmation hearings, I think for the appellate court, she said, you know, split infinitives make her blister. And there are just a lot of people who pride themselves on their writing, learn those rules and follow them, not knowing that actually doesn't matter. And there are a lot of copy editors that will correct that. There's a funny story, which I did a little bit of research in the book about this story. Turns out it's not really true, unfortunately, but there's a story that goes around that says one time Winston Churchill, who was really crafted his speeches very carefully, he worked on his prose very carefully, he apparently, a copy editor or sub-editor, they call it in England, wrote in the margin, you know, don't split the infinitive, or no, I think actually it was a different, I'm wrong, it was Raymond Chandler, I think, the funny story, who he said to his editor at The Atlantic, when I split an infinitive, God damn it, I split it so that it stays split. So, you know, there are these stories, and I think George Bernard Shaw, there's a story about George Bernard Shaw as well, you know, these stories of famous writers, very careful about their prose, who resist this.
Well, they're leading the charge, but I guess the charge hasn't been won yet. Well, we're talking with Constance Hale. She is a writer, editor, and best-selling author of Sin and Syntax. And her articles have appeared in the New York Times, the Atlantic Monthly, and the Smithsonian. Her new book, the one we're talking about today, it's called Vex, Hex, Smash, Smooch. Let Verbs Power Your Writing. And we're taking your questions and your comments about the use of verbs in our language. If you've got questions about the split infinitive, tricky conjugations, let us know how you'd like to answer those questions. Constance Hale is here for us this hour. Our number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send your email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hurricane Sandy paralyzed Manhattan and left millions in the dark, showing just how vulnerable our aging cities are. Join Ira Flatow on Science Friday at 1 o'clock today as we talk about rebuilding our infrastructure for the storms of the future. That's 1 o'clock's Talk of the Nation, Science Friday. I'm Veronica Rickert with you this morning on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio as we talk about verbs with our guest Constance Hale. She's the author of Vex, Hex, Smash, Smooch, Let Verbs Power Your Writing. And we're getting inside the world and the usage of verbs. And we'll take our first phone call now. We've got Peggy. She's joining us from Wauwatosa. Hey, Peggy.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question was about changing a noun into a verb. Mm. I have done some freelance writing for a big city newspaper, and I used the term aproned as a verb regarding to a house. It aproned with a porch from end to end. The house contradicts itself by feeling both substantial and cozy. Am I using the word? Is this kosher to do?
I like it.
No, I love it. It's a great it's metaphor, and I'll come back to that in just a moment. But there is this idea, this really wrong-headed idea, this is another thing, that when a noun is a noun and always must be a noun, a verb is a verb and always must be a verb. Actually, this is one of the really cool things about English, and this goes way back to early English, is that we shift things around a lot. The linguists call it a functional shift when you take a word that has one function and you give it another function. And this is so common. In fact, this is a way that a lot of words get invented in English. Think about the verb babysit. Well, one time it was babysitter. Or the word burgle, which came from burglar. We do this a lot. And I think it's great because, as you just showed in your example, it's a way of taking a noun, turning it into a verb, and creating a metaphor. The reason apron works so well is that it's visual. You're describing the way that porch looks attached to the house, but you're also taking advantage of some of the associations with the word of cooking, home, kitchen, coziness, I think was what you referred to. And that's wonderful. Some great writers, I can give you an example. I live in San Francisco, and we just finished the World Series, so I've been listening to a lot of sports casting and watching some sports writing, and there's a great essay by Roger Angel that ran in The New Yorker, and he's describing that thing that catchers do when they're sitting at the plate communicating with the pitcher, and they move their fingers and all that. Well, we don't have a verb for that, right? Roger Angel invented one. He said that a catcher was semaphoring a plan. Mm. There, he's taking a semaphore, which is a system of making signals, turning it into a verb.
Nice.
It's a perfect verb in that situation. So as long as it's done, not overdone, it's a great way to add specificity and also kind of connotations into your writing. That said, there is one note of caution, and that is, it works when you have a very specific noun and you turn it into a verb and it's a very specific verb. It doesn't work when you start with an abstract noun that maybe we don't even know. It's not visual. It's not concrete. It's not specific. And you take that abstraction and you turn that into a verb. That's not the right way to go. So that's why you'll hear a lot of people railing against the use of impact as a verb or contact as a verb. If you think of contact as a noun, what does that mean? Well, it's kind of vague, actually. It's kind of abstract. Then you turn it into a verb. It would be much better to say call or email or write than to say contact. So, again, what makes the verb work is always how specific is it? Am I giving my reader a visual image, something the reader can literally see? Or am I just taking what's kind of not a great word to start with and making not a great verb out of it?
And Constance, this is something that happens a lot in pop culture especially, isn't it, turning a noun into a verb?
Sure. I mean, it really happens in all culture, really in high literature. Shakespeare did it. And I think Hamlet says, dog him at the heels. He uses dog as a verb. So it definitely happens in high literature, and it certainly happens in pop culture. I mean, the example that comes to my mind that we use all the time is Googling. You know, Google started out as a noun, as a brand name. Now we say, I'm going to go Google someone. But we know what that means. It's very specific. I know exactly. It means I'm going to go search on Google. And it's a more economical way of saying it.
Well, thank you so much, Peggy. That was a great example. And we go next to Brad. And Brad is with us from Mequon. Hi, Brad.
Hello. Yes, I just wanted to relate an anecdote. You had earlier talked about Winston Churchill and then switching to Raymond Chandler. But
yep.
I recall reading that at one point some editor accused Winston Churchill of ending a sentence with a preposition.
Exactly.
And he responded, that is the sort of arrogant pedantry up with which I refuse to put.
Up with which I will not put, yeah. Thank you for bringing up that example. And again, it's something that I do talk about in the book because there is this myth that you're not supposed to end a sentence with a preposition. That gets taught in a lot of English classes, and a lot of people have the idea that that's true. It's not true. It's never been true in English. I can give you a number of examples where you have to end a sentence on a preposition in order to make sense. And that quote is attributed to Winston Churchill. I got a little bit suspicious of that quote, though, because I saw it in a number of different books, and each time I saw it, it was slightly different, which as a journalist, I know that when you start finding a quote that somehow is never quoted the same, it might not have ever been uttered. And I did some research and found that there's a colleague of mine in New York, Ben Zimmer. He's a great linguist, and he actually went back all the way to, I think it was 1942, and found that quote. It's been attributed to Winston Churchill for decades, but actually, it was some British bureaucrat who said it, said some version of it, and then the quote kept getting sort of better and better and better, and eventually attributed to Winston Churchill. So unfortunately, the quote's not exactly true, but the point is true, which is that it's ridiculous to tell someone that they're wrong if they write a sentence and end it with a preposition.
You know, how do these things get so ingrained, though, if they're not true?
That's such an interesting question. I've thought a lot about that. And number one, there's for a lot of these things, there's a good reason behind it. So, for example, the example that Peggy brought up of can you use a noun as a verb? Well, there's a reason people say that is because a lot of times we take abstract nouns and we end up with abstract verbs and they're not good verbs. So there's often a reason there, but and in the case of ending a sentence with a preposition, prepositions usually have objects, so prepositions are often followed by a noun, and that's called the object of the preposition, and it's a good idea to keep those things together. It's a pair. They dance together in a sentence, and we don't really want to decouple them. If we do decouple them, like if the noun's at the beginning of the sentence and the preposition is at the end of the sentence, you lose something in clarity by separating those two things that go together. So I think that's probably why the rule started.
So more of a rule of thumb?
Yeah, it's just in a really long sentence. If you have a long, complicated sentence and you separate those two parts, that's not a good thing. But that doesn't mean you can't end a sentence on a preposition. It means you shouldn't separate an object from its preposition in a long, complicated sentence. But the problem is when you're trying to teach this stuff, and I have a lot of sympathy for teachers trying to teach grammar to rambunctious kids, I think you want black and white rules. It's nice to have black and white rules to to give students, and it means you don't maybe have to think as hard about the language because language has a lot of shades of gray, frankly. Language is complicated. It's a little bit mysterious. And so I think a lot of times when we try to come up with these hard and fast black and white rules, they end up evolving and getting repeated, and they don't actually comport with the language that we speak and write in.
But Constance, I get the impression that you're kind of a rebel. And if we all go out after this show and we're splitting our infinitives and we're ending with prepositions, aren't the Lynn Trusses of the world going to point out the error of our ways?
You know, what's the best revenge is living well or something? I think, you know, the best revenge is writing well. If you write well and your readers love what you write and understand what you write, that's actually the point of it all and what matters, and these rules don't really matter. There are the sticklers, but I think part of the reason I write the books that I do, both Sin and Syntax and Vex, Hex, Smash, Smooch, is I want to give readers a deeper sense of language so that if someone does question them, for example, If someone questioned you in your writing, you say, hey, no. Actually, it's been like this in English for a long time, and you can give examples. I mean, that's part of the fun of my book, is to feel like I'm giving people a fuller, more complete sense of English so that when they are corrected by, you know, these errant pedants, as the fake Winston Churchill would say, we can sort of say no. Here's an example, and this is actually the way English works.
We can say in your face, Constance yeah. Hale says.
I'm not really a rebel, but I'll tell you, Veronica, I do have a really different approach, I think, to this stuff than a lot of people who write books on writing, and I'll tell you where that comes from. I grew up in Hawaii, and I grew up speaking standard English at home, at the dinner table, and on the phone, which my parents insisted upon. And Pidgin English, which is our Hawaiian Creole, in school and on the beach and with my friends. And I kind of grew up speaking two Englishes, one standard, one non-standard, one supposedly good and right, the other supposedly bad and wrong. And I grew up noticing that stories were always funnier when we told them in Pidgin. Jokes were funnier. There was something about Pidgin that I really loved. It was a kind of guttural, rhythmic, very musical language, and I think it gave me an ear for language, speaking that. So that I don't really consider myself a rebel, but I think I'm a little bit, I have a different perspective on English that I don't think, and now, and of course I grew up to be a writer and an editor, and I see that sometimes the best sentences are ones that break the rules. Some of the best writing is when a writer knows the rules, knows how to do things right, and consciously bends them a little bit. That makes for often the most exciting writing, and I can think we could probably just start going nuts with ads that are really effective that are not exactly pristine grammar, like Got Milk, hugely successful ad campaign. It's not exactly what your English teacher would give you an A for. And that's the way language works. Language is kind of low to the ground, and so I don't really think I'm not trying to upset the apple cart too much, but I am trying to get people to enjoy language the way it is. Enjoy the robustness and the low-to-the-ground quality of English, and have fun with it.
Well, let's go to our next caller now. Sarah is with us from Zion, Illinois. Hi, Sarah.
Hi there. Okay, I've been a stickler for grammar, not really hardcore, but I like things to be the way I think they should be. But then lately I've been asking some questions about that, and I called into the program Away with Words about why we don't have a language academy, and are there any rules really in English if we don't have a language academy? And they had a really interesting answer to that, and basically they were saying that the English speaking, in England they didn't want to submit themselves to the tyranny of a language academy. They wanted to be really democratic, and that just made me realize that I don't think there really are any rules per se in English. That, you know, our rules, is it true that they just come to us from some editors getting together and kind of deciding what should be the rules? And isn't English just a language that evolves and reflects common uses? I just wanted to see what you know,
yeah. I wouldn't go so far as that. I think, first of all, just to back up on the Language Academy, you're absolutely right. In France, for example, they have the Académie Française, which lays down the rules of what words are French and what words aren't French, and there was always a resistance in English to that, both in England and also in the United States, because, well, Jonathan Swift, actually, the author of Gulliver's Travels, was one of many poets along the centuries who have said we should have an academy, we should tame our language a bit. And then there are always people like, you know, Mark Twain or Walt Whitman and others who say, why on earth would we want to tame it? So there's always, to me, that's, I have a whole chapter on this in my book, actually, called The Grammar Wars, because it's been, over the course of four centuries, there's been this tension between the people who kind of want rules and want clarity and the people who don't want rules. And sometimes it's called the tension between the prescriptivists and the descriptivists. In other words, the people who tell you what you should and shouldn't do and the people who just describe the way language works without care for rules. So there is this polarity, I guess, you know, or these two opposite poles. And there has been a conflict among people who study language or consider themselves experts in language. And there's still that conflict today. It rages between, say, linguists and grammarians. All that said, there are some rules, and the problem is they often are not the rules that were taught in school. So there are some underlying, I call them underlying codes, because I don't want to use the word rules. We know how sentences work in English. We do have subjects, and we do have predicates, and we do tend to, we use our pronouns in a certain way, and it does add to clarity if you use, it helps to know the difference between who and whom. It helps a listener understand what you're saying and a reader understand what you're saying. So we do want to write in a way that is clear and that a writer, me as a writer, I want to be able to control my sentence somewhat and know how things work so that I can, I hate to use the word manipulate, but so I can kind of manipulate the words and manipulate the order and manipulate the rhythm and manipulate the music of the sentence so that when a reader of mine reads it, that reader gets the meaning crystal clear, but also has a certain emotional response. So as a writer, you want to have a very sophisticated sense of language, and that is really what my books are about. It's not about these kind of hard and fast false rules, but it's really about how does language work, how do sentences tick, and how can we as speakers and writers do it more effectively. Sometimes that involves breaking some of those rules, but it's with a very high level of awareness of how sentences tick.
Great. Well, thank you so much for bringing that up, Sarah. Appreciate the call. And let's go next to Tom. Tom joining us from Thiensville. Hi there.
Hi. My question is, you may have answered this already, but when I write in blogs or email messages, I find that I'm using the forms of the verb to be mm-hmm. almost in every sentence, and I'm trying to get away from that. What's the best way to do that? I would assume maybe reading that book that you've mentioned here.
Yeah, well, I do have an entire chapter on this question as well. Basically, just to go back and explain one thing, I think we have two basic kinds of verbs in English. I call them static verbs and dynamic verbs. Obviously, dynamic verbs, we can tell what they do. They're dynamic. They're the action words. They put the power in the sentences. Static verbs are verbs like to be, is, was, were, maybe some other verbs like seems and appears. They set up a very different kind of sentence, and a sentence that's really noun-heavy because they are just, the static verbs are like a little equal sign between nouns and adjectives. So there's nothing wrong with them per se. They serve a function, and sometimes we want to use them, but for some reason, which I personally can't explain, that seems to be the default verb. We often write in those. The only way to correct it is to stop and go back over your sentences, circle every is or was or were, and see if you can recast the sentence. So I did give the example earlier of the shoes are at the door, and the number of different verbs you can choose in that sentence to make the sentence more descriptive. But it's really a practice that you have to impose upon yourself. Usually when I'm rewriting a manuscript, I have one pass through the manuscript that I call the verb check. And I just go through and I look at all the verbs and I say, first of all, am I using too many static verbs? And sometimes those static verbs could be dynamic. And then once I make sure that I'm not overusing static verbs, then the next question is, have I picked the best dynamic verb? And literally, I think that's the most important thing you can do in a rewrite is go through and just check your verbs. And it's just a great way to check your sentences and give a little more sophistication to the prose.
All right. Well, I hope that helps, Tom. I appreciate that. As we talk this hour with Constance Hale, who is a writer, editor, and the best-selling author of Sin and Syntax, her new book is called Vex, Hex, Smash, Smooch, Let Verbs Power Your Writing. And we're talking all things verb this morning. And we'd love to take your questions and your comments at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send your email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Veronica Rickert, back with you this Friday morning on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And I hope you'll stick around next hour as we talk about Shakespeare Link Canada. It's a program that raises HIV/AIDS awareness and gender equality issues in Africa using Shakespeare. And we'll be talking about that after 10 o'clock. This hour, we're talking verbs with our guest, Constance Hale. She's a writer and editor, and her new book is called Vex, Hex, Smash, and Smooch. We're talking about the world of verbs, how to understand them, and to get the most bang for your verb buck. And we'll go to our next caller right now. We've got Leah. Leah joins us from Green Bay. Hi there.
Hi. Well, Constance, first, thanks. I love your ideas. I have an observation and also a question. I help people write their life stories, and getting back to your pidgin English, I had a client who was telling me about a situation in court, and so he said, and I says to the judge, what kind of judge are you? And if I had changed that, you know, if I said to the judge, it wouldn't have been as good. Mm-hmm. So I left it the way it was. But my real question is, I appreciate what you're saying about verbs, but couldn't you accomplish the same thing? Like, let's say the shoes were stood sloppily near the door, or lazily near the door. You know, in other words, use adverbs to do what you're trying to do with the verb.
You know, absolutely. That's why adverbs exist. Adverbs have four functions, actually. They can tell us when, where, how, and how much. And adverbs that end in ly, like lazily, tell us how much. Here's the thing, though. Adverbs can definitely add more precision, and when an adverb is modifying a verb, it can make the verb more precise. But there are many, most often, instead of doing the hard work of finding a better verb, we choose a mediocre verb and we pump it up with an adverb. So I think that it's a better practice to try to find a verb that says that. Not that you shouldn't use, I'm not one of those people who says take all adverbs out of your writing, take all adjectives out of your writing. They serve a purpose. But a lot of us, if we pick really great nouns, we don't need as many adjectives. If we pick really great verbs, we don't need as many adverbs. Our sentences become cleaner. I also don't think every sentence should be five words and five words the max. Or I'm not one of those people who thinks you necessarily have to write with fewer words. But if you clunk, I think of a sentence sometimes, I visualize a boat. I visualize a boat moving in the water, because every sentence is basically something moving in a direction. It's a story moving in a certain direction. The more tow lines you hang off of that boat, the slower the boat is going to move. And that's true with sentences. What make up the body of the boat are nouns and verbs. And then the more adjectives and adverbs and prepositional phrases and other things that you hang off of those words, the more the sentence slows down and the more muddy it can get. So again, sometimes I feel like I'm talking out of both sides of my mouth. On the one hand, sure, use adjectives and adverbs if they're precise, if they make your sentence more clear or richer or more fun. Use them. But be aware that they can also, we tend to overuse them. We tend to load things up with adjectives and adverbs. And as a result, our writing can get kind of muddy and clunked up.
Which makes perfect sense. But as you said, on the other hand, we don't want everyone writing like Hemingway.
Exactly.
Spartan sentences. It's not everyone's style either. Some people are more florid.
You know, and I'm so glad you mentioned this idea of style, because really, you know, we've been talking a lot about grammar. I love it that your callers have these very specific grammatical questions. But the real purpose of my book is ultimately style. It's not to be grammatically correct per se, but to actually have more control over how you use sentence, how you use verbs, how you structure your sentences. Because style is ultimate point. And, you know, every writer, I think, is, you know, you're engaged in a process as a writer of finding your true voice. And as you say, Hemingway had his voice. I have my voice. Susan Orlean has her voice. And part of the process of developing this voice is playing with these different elements and learning how to modulate things so that it really does come out the way that sounds natural to you or just the most appropriate to you.
Well, let's go next to Sherry. Sherry in Middleton is with us. Hi there.
Hello. I have a question about whether, I believe there's a theory that syntax may have been an evolutionary change enabling better communication in humans. Are you aware of that? Do you have any knowledge of it?
Sure. So this is, we're going into linguistics now and the science of studying language, which is a relatively new science in a couple hundred years. And in the 20th century and now certainly in the 21st century, linguists have been, originally I think linguists were studying the history of language and maybe even the history of English. More and more linguists are looking at evolutionary biology and trying to understand why humans have the form of language we do and other animals don't. And what this thing syntax is after all. And I think what you're referring to is the theory of Noam Chomsky, who is kind of the big kahuna of linguists at MIT. And he had two sort of core beliefs that were articulated in the middle of the 20th century. One was there's this universal grammar that all languages share some kind of underlying universal grammar. And that is his theory. It has yet to be proved or shown. The other theory that he had was that we acquired language in a kind of genetic mutation or a genetic big bang. Like we didn't have it, and then there was a genetic mutation in our brains, and then we did have language or syntax. That's a controversial idea, and there are many evolutionary biologists who disagree with that, and then many linguists now subscribe to a different thought that actually language really did evolve over many years, and it wasn't just a mutation in our brain. It was also we had to develop the capacity in our throats and our jaws and our tongues. You know, there was a lot of physical things that happened along with the evolution in the brain, and it was a long, slow process. And there are many linguists, well, biologists who are looking at other animals, too, and what we're learning is that other animals have more sophisticated language than we realized in earlier years. I hope that answers your question.
it's very helpful. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Sherry. What do you think, Constance?
Oh, I think I'm an evolutionist. I think it just makes sense to me that, you know, there was a little evolution in our heads, and then maybe there was a little evolution in our brains, and then things just went back and forth and back and forth, and over through evolution, we happened to be lucky enough to get this incredibly rich language system. But I was fascinated in some of my research in looking at what some linguists have postulated about what our first words were. And this gets into some really geeky grammar, but it's interesting to me. You know, there's these weird words in English, interjections. And if you study grammar and you study syntax, you're like, what are these interjections? It's weird because unlike every other part of speech, they kind of don't have a function. You just stick them into a sentence. An interjection might be something like, geez, or boy, or hey. And they get thrown into a sentence, and you can put them in or take them out, and the sentence stays the same structurally. They have no impact on syntax. I've always been kind of interested, like, why do we have this one word that relates to all the other words in a completely different way? I was fascinated when I did some research on the evolution of language, and there's a linguist at Tufts who's studied this a lot, and those are probably vestiges from an early, what they call a proto-language. So before we actually had syntax and this way of forming sentences that we have in today, we probably just spoke in interjections. There was probably this kind of early proto-language, pre-language, where it was really grunts and groans and things like hey or psst or whatever. And those words are still with us, even though language has kind of evolved beyond them.
Feel so natural, don't they?
They do.
I can't imagine language without them. In a way, they're the fun part.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's so interesting. Well, let's take another phone call as we get toward the end of the hour here. We'll go next to Vivian from Green Bay. Hi, Vivian.
Hello. I have a question about the evolution and the acceptance of a change in language. Your guest recently said, me as a writer. I am hearing me constantly, especially from younger children. I'm hearing things as... him and his mother, me and my friend went. Is that evolution? Because your guest is using it. Do we pay attention to the misuse of me? For me, it's a chalkboard screech kind of thing. I want to scream out,
and
I,
good
as a writer.
Well, it depends on the sentence, actually. But the difference that you're talking about is what grammarians call the objective case and the subjective case. So if I am the subject of a sentence, I would use I. If I'm an object in the sentence, I would use me. Sometimes me can be thrown in almost like an interjection. If I say I, me, Connie, it's like a way of adding emphasis, and that's not incorrect to add it into a sentence like that. But I think what you're talking about really is when more and more people use the objective case when they need to use the subjective case. And you see it a lot with kids. I don't think it's really, it doesn't bother me as much with kids because I think it's part of children learning language that they scramble subjects and objects when they're around 4, 5, 6. Then they tend to listen well and evolve out of that. But it's certainly, that's one of those things. As I was saying earlier, I think there are some grammatical rules that are helpful. I mentioned who and whom. It's helpful to know the difference between who and whom. It's helpful to know the difference between I and me, because when you use pronouns correctly in a sentence, it helps the listener or the reader have more clarity about who is the subject of the sentence and who's the object. That's kind of geeky grammar, Vivian, but that's my answer to that.
So it sounds like a little give and take.
Well, yeah, you know, and it's interesting. One of our earlier callers mentioned how she kept I says to the judge, how she kept that in because somehow that seemed more authentic to the character and it really sounded like him. And I think sometimes there are a lot of blues songs, for example, that mash up pronouns terribly, and it's part of the character of the song. So this is a delicate thing. Sometimes you want to make the grammar correct because it helps clarity. Sometimes actually the bad grammar is truer in some kind of way.
Well, thanks so much for your call, Vivian, and good luck writing out the me's that you hear in your life. And we have time for one more quick phone call, very quick. Ken in Waukesha, you're next.
Good morning, Veronica and Constance. I'm just at home doing my chores, and as I listen to you speak, Constance, I stop doing my chores and I just sit down to listen because it's so refreshing and enchanting to listen to someone who loves the language so much and has obviously done her homework, and you've arrived at an understanding of language that shows... that allows breathing room for the language. You're not an ideologue or a pedant, and it's just really the everyday person listening to the show would come away with so much, such greater ability to write and speak after listening to the way you speak about language. I can't wait to read one of your books and learn more. Terrific program. Thank you.
Oh, well, thank you, Ken. And you're right. I see language more than anything else. I see language as something that we should enjoy playing with. It's fun. It's interesting. And I want to encourage creativity more than anything else.
Well, Ken, thank you so much for your phone call. Appreciate you keeping it short. And Constance, we've got about 30 seconds here, but is that pretty much the takeaway of your book? You know, get out there and play in this language and keep it vital.
Sure, and learn some of the devices that you can use when you're writing to have more control and to allow you to be more sophisticated in the way you use language.
Well, Constance, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you, Veronica.
Constance Hale, our guest this morning as we toured Verbs. She is a writer and editor and the best-selling author of Sin and Syntax. Her articles have appeared in the New York Times, the Atlantic Monthly, and the Smithsonian. And her latest book we discussed it this morning, it's called Vex, Hex, Smash, Smooch. Let Verbs Power Your Writing. And I want to thank Marika Suval for screening your phone calls this morning and Rhonda Fanning for technical direction. I'm Veronica Rickert, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.